Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Friends of the Earth Clean Air Special with Sean Williams from National Friends of the Earth and Phoebe Holmes from Bristol Friends of the Earth, looking at their campaign back earlier this year, which was stopped when the council took down the Cube on the Bear Pit, which is the city's only non-commercial billboard. Also, David Scott from the Fresh Start Foundation. They aim to give genuine advice to those suffering child sexual abuse and their families up in Scotland, where the authorities have failed. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you've got a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Phoebe Holmes and Sean Williams. First, you, Phoebe, both of you are part of Friends of the Earth. Can you tell us how you fit in with Friends of the Earth here in Bristol?
Yep. Last November, I sort of went knocking around on several environmental organisations' doors to try and see if I could get involved. Got a call back from Friends of the Earth, Bristol Friends of the Earth, who went and had a coffee with one of the managers and sort of had a chat about how I could sort of put my input into it. It was really, really open from the start. It was really great to, it was a sort of the perfect time really. They were just kicking off the Clean Air campaign, working towards some goals that were coming up early 2018. Just managed to get involved in a few different ways, set up a website and sort of, had a really varied role from the really beginning.
Okay, so what about a day job? Have you got a day job? And is this something that you can sort of fit in your spare time? You feel like this is something that maybe you ought to be doing, but you haven't got time to do because of your day job?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, originally that is why I did it. I mean, when I first was working with Bristol Friends of the Earth, I was committing one day a week to the campaign. Unfortunately, that isn't really, you know, possible in a sort of unpaid capacity. So I've had to take a little bit of a step back recently. I charity fundraise for a living, you know, I do 40 hours there. So I do try and squeeze it in the mornings, in the weekends. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, I would love to be doing this full time. But for now, this is as much as I can fit in.
Okay, so Clean Air was just coming along, rolling along on the horizon at Friends of the Earth. What did you decide to do with it? And to what extent was that the campaign's decision, and to what extent was it your decision as to where it went?
Well, Bristol Friends of the Earth have a few different campaigns that they do. They do stuff about bees, trees, you know, food. They have other campaigns, but there was national sort of stuff going on regarding the clean air, sort of outcomes. So that was the one that was really taking precedent at that time. And there were some decisions going on from the council that was coming up that we were trying to sort of focus our work around. So that really was the main.
Clean air is a difficult thing for Bristol because we've got a prevailing westerly wind and we've got Avonmouth downwind of us, or is it upwind? I'm not sure. But anyway, constantly blowing in this direction. We're also told that if there's any sort of disaster at Hinkley Point Power Station, the nuclear power station, if the wind is in the usual direction, it might well blow straight towards Bristol. So clean air is not necessarily guaranteed here, is it? So anyway, what did you discover about the air in the city and how clean it is or isn't?
Well, I feel like a lot of people have a perception of Bristol as being, you know, super green and clean, you know, lots of sort of vegan cafes around and cyclists. But, you know, it's been, you know, there's been a breach of legal air pollution in the city for over, you know, several decades. So I was, you know, quite shocked even myself to kind of lift those myths that I even sort of believed.
Well, hang on, because if you're breaking the law, don't the police come along and grab hold of your collar and drag you off and put handcuffs on you?
Well, apparently not in this case. They should do, but no, it's not been happening here.
So I imagine it's probably civil law, not criminal law. What are the actual limits? Who sets them? Do you know? I mean, what should they be here in Bristol?
The limits are set by WHO, World Health Organization, and central government. Sean, you might know the actual limits, the figures.
I can come in on this if you like, Tony, just because the what's going on in Bristol at the moment is being driven by particular laws at European level. And so those breaches are in relation to nitrous oxides. And there is a threshold of 40 micrograms. And in some parts of Bristol, we're actually looking at around 90 sometimes.
So you know what? Okay, immediately what this makes me think is that, well, we're going to be leaving the European Union. So maybe the authorities, both here in the city and nationally, are crossing their fingers and thinking, right, we'll be out soon. And everyone would have forgotten about these limits.
What we've seen in the UK is that Client Earth has been incredibly tenacious in challenging the UK government to take these limits seriously and to comply with the laws.
Who has?
Client Earth, which is a campaigning law firm, has actually challenged the UK government three times. It's dragged the government through the courts, and governments repeatedly failed to come up with a satisfactory plan. So we're in a position now where the High Court has said that these limits need to be met the laws need to be met in the shortest time possible. And what central government has done is kind of shoved a lot of that responsibility onto local authorities.
Well, the easiest thing to do, if I was the mayor here in Bristol, is to say, oh, I know, let's just have a congestion charge and let's just charge everybody going in and out. I mean, what's the Friends of the Earth's position on that? Because this is the stick approach, is it? It's not the carrot approach by saying, actually, there are better ways to get in and out of the city. Mm. For example, public transport, expanding the rail network, building a tram, an underground, these kinds of things.
Yeah.
And obviously, the whole idea of a congestion charge is a massive, massive money spinner as well.
So Friends of the Earth's position on this really is that you should have carrots, sticks, anything in between that gets to a solution in the shortest time possible, but also in the fairest way possible. So what we're seeing at the moment is a process that's driven by compliance. And so central government's been very micromanaging in the way that it's sort of proposing solutions. So what we've got in Bristol at the moment, we've got few options that are clean air zones, which would look at charging certain the most polluting vehicles for moving around, and one option which isn't, which would look at actually outright bans of certain kinds of vehicles, and we'd say that that's not enough because that is stick and solely stick. And although local authorities will have access to funding to try and mitigate some of the impacts of that, what we need to see is a really wholesale shift in the way that we approach space and movement in our cities.
I mean, is there any real possibility of having better public transport? I mean, everyone in Bristol, I think, has been talking about this for at least 40 years or so. We need better public transport. We get Metro Bus, which has hardly made any difference whatsoever. And I'm afraid I'm a bit cynical. I think maybe that was the whole point of Metro Bus, is that it was going to be a fairly high-profile project that wasn't really going to make much difference to the people's dependency on getting in and out by car.
I mean, we've got terrible historic underinvestment in public transport in this whole part of the country, really. It's not just Bristol, it's the whole of the southwest of England. And the problem we're facing with air pollution does need a very immediate solution, which is one of the reasons we're looking at sticks in the short term. But I think what we'd like to see is something, for instance, like a diesel scrappage scheme. So if you do own an older diesel vehicle and you bought that in good faith because the incentives were set up in such a way that that was the right option, you thought you were doing the right thing by the planet because it was better in terms of climate change to do that than a petrol vehicle, those people should be offered a really coherent alternative in terms of something like an integrated travel pass. So you've got a season ticket for the train. You can pick up one of the Yo bikes in town. You can hop on and off of a bus and you're not being charged through the nose for that. So something like that would start to approach
Friends of the Earth. Yeah. Friends of the Earth got it wrong, didn't they? They said actually that diesel was better than petrol, but then actually now we're told the opposite. I mean, you can understand why consumers, car drivers particularly, rather feel that they're being lied to, and they're stopping trusting a lot of environmentalists.
I don't think it's Friends of the Earth that have got that wrong, actually, but governments did take certain decisions in terms of financial incentives that have led to consumers behaving in certain ways, and I think they're justified in some cases in feeling that they're being messed about. I think really what we're seeing is, you know, the consequences of a lot of short-termism And really, the money should have been going into public transport all along. I mean, we're seeing now with this current government a road building scheme that is of the same sort of scale as the Thatcher government tried to pursue. And we saw the sort of resistance there was to that. And so, I mean, if you build more roads, then you create more traffic. And that's something that we've known about, there's been good evidence for since the 1920s. And yet, generation after generation of planners has chosen to disregard that evidence and to continue ploughing investment into roads.
Okay, the long and short of it is that there was this campaign the beginning of 2018, and I'm just looking at a picture of a billboard which says 297 deaths per year associated with air pollution in Bristol. And if you want to look that up, it's tinyurl.com/BR Clean Air. I suppose that's Bristol Clean Air, but BR Clean Air. And online you will find, I suppose, some more information about this. And there's also a hashtag on Twitter, Let Bristol Breathe. Now, I guess this is partly your work, Phoebe, is it?
Yeah, well, we did some sort of research, getting some stats around the air pollution effects.
But where did you
Bristol.
Come up with 297? It's a bit very precise, isn't it?
Yeah, so that, that figure is given in Air Quality Consultants' February 2017 report. The figure comes from an estimated range which is between 101 to 612 deaths, which is what those academics have come up with. So that's obviously bang in the middle of that. Also, it's quite sort of important to say that you know, figure, it would vary very massively depending on where you are in the city. You know, if you're in the city centre, that's, you're going to be far more at risk than, you know, someone who's on the outskirts. But that's where that figure came from.
The junction 3 at the M32 is not going to be all that clean, is it? I mean, this
certainly
is
not.
Anywhere near the motorways is not good. I suppose if you're higher up in Clifton, the air is cleaner. I don't
Absolutely.
Know, am I right?
You would be right, definitely.
Anyway, so the Bear Pit is another part of the city at the bottom of Gloucester Road, which is there's just a tremendous amount of traffic there. It must be one of the hot spots for pollution. And
Absolutely.
The other part of the billboard, which was up there, in March this year, in the beginning of this year, said, warning, you are now entering dangerous and illegal air pollution. Again, the hashtag, Let Bristol Breathe. So this actually was taken down by the city council. How did you first hear about that? Or
I saw it on my way to work, rather devastatingly, saw a barren
so how,
emptiness.
I mean, what work had you put into that to actually put it up there in the first place?
Yeah, well, it was sort of, we were trying to think about alternative ways where we could get people in the city talking about air pollution and the clean air campaign that we were doing. And I was trying to kind of think how we could capture the attention of people who might not necessarily be interested in clean air. And, you know, we work in Brunswick Court, which is very, very near the very sort of artistic centre of Bristol. And it kind of just struck me that, you know, we could just get a mural up and that, you know, people talk about graffiti in the city. It's a really, really great way and alternative way to sort of, get people's attention, basically.
Well, it's much better than looking at some of these boring ads for
Absolutely.
Pensions or
exactly.
That sort of,
so,
you know, there's all sorts
amazing.
Of cars as well. They seem to have loads of car adverts up on these billboards.
Yeah.
But you had access to this completely unique billboard in the city, which was you could pick pretty much what you want on there.
Well, we had worked before I actually joined Bristol Friends of the Earth. I know the group had worked with PRSC in the past, so the sort of initial contact was quite smooth. And the guys at PRSC are really, you know, they're really cool and they're really into sort of social change and stuff like that. So they were totally on board with getting this up there. And they said, you know, they'd been meaning to sort of update and get something fresh on there.
So what happened when you were on your way to work? Did you shout up at the people? What did you?
No, it wasn't getting taken down. It was already gone. And then I was just, you know, I was really heartbroken because it obviously is the biggest achievement I've ever had in my working life. And, you know, it was amazing. And also, you know, it's the last non-corporate billboard that I've sort of seen anywhere. So it's, you know, it's a real shame.
It's really disappointing. What we've wanted to try and do since we've been active on this in Bristol is really try and stimulate an informed discussion about how the city tackles its air pollution in the fairest way, in the most effective way possible. I think some of our earlier discussion has sort of highlighted what a what a wicked problem this air pollution can be to try and tackle fairly. And so starting from a position of agreeing some facts and having people be familiar with some of the facts about the damage that's done by air pollution, we thought is a good starting place. And from there, we can start to talk about some of the solutions.
Yeah, but it's not Beijing here, is it?
not as far as I know, no. But I think
I suppose the point really is to stop it becoming like Beijing, to make sure, I mean, you know, you have whole weeks where you just cannot breathe in Beijing.
And I think one of the dimensions of this that's really troubling is the environmental justice dimension. So some of the people who are least responsible for causing this problem are actually suffering the effects most. So half of households in Lawrence Hill, for instance, don't own a car, and yet they're some of the highest levels of pollution in the city. Some of the most deprived parts of the city are in that ward as well. And one of the stats we had on the board as well, you might have seen, is that the kids aged between 8 and 10 years old who live in highly polluted parts of cities had up to 10% less lung capacity than usual. And the evidence suggests that they never recover that. And so kids, it's very difficult to point a finger at a child and say, you've had a hand in causing this problem, and yet they are disproportionately vulnerable as a group.
Phoebe, have you got any plans to do anything about your message, your quite important message about our young people's health, the poorer people in the city's health?
Yeah, well, that's the biggest part of it for me, is the injustice in that, you know, as Sean was just explaining, the people who are getting hit the hardest from this are the people that are doing the least to contribute to it. A lot of the pollution is coming in from outskirts of the city and people driving right into their sort of city centre offices. So, yeah, I mean, I would love to, you know, keep doing work to try and influence the council and really keep pushing for those bold decisions to be made.
But hang on, if you were mayor, what would you do? Because it's always easy to say, oh, they're not doing enough, but what would you do?
Ban the most polluting vehicles and drill more money into sustainable solutions like public transport.
The work we did in the beer pit was sort of one aspect of the campaigning in Bristol, and the statement we made to council was based on some incredible community engagement that we did in Lawrence Hill and Easton. But right now we've got a petition that's running. So if you visit Bristol Friends of the Earth's Facebook page, you'll see it there. It's calling on the mayor of Bristol to do everything in his power to make sure that the air pollution in this city is cleaned up as fairly and as effectively as possible. So great if you can get along there and sign it, please.
Phoebe Holmes and Sean Williams, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you,
Danny. Thank you so much.
This part of Dialect is not suitable for children. Please make sure your radio is turned off or down if you've got children around.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And my name is David Scott. I'm part of a group in Scotland called the Fresh Start Foundation, and we are People's Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, founded in the wake of the heads of the government inquiry being forced out of office by a very scurrilous and government orchestrated campaign to undermine them, and specifically the chair, Susan O'Brien QC, and also the tendency of the government inquiry to be very narrow, to exclude the vast majority of abuse and to leave so many questions unasked and unanswered. So we formed a people's group to do an inquiry which was completely and totally independent from government. We don't take a single penny from any government source. And what we've started off doing is a roadshow programme over 2 years, 36 roadshows. So we're visiting every local authority in Scotland, and we're visiting all the main cities twice to make people aware of what we're doing, and to get victims, survivors and members of the public to engage and support our activities.
What's your experience of what the patterns of these abuses in Scotland? Because I know in the UK, a lot of it seems to have been going in within the state care system, which is particularly worrying because children would have been taken away from their parents to be put into the state care system, only then to have been abused, which seems to be a horrific, you know, maybe they would have been better off with their parents. But what's been the experience in Scotland?
Well, there's a multitude of lines that this goes down. State care homes certainly is one of them. An awful lot of abuse within church-run homes. The Roman Catholic Church is being somewhat exposed in the official inquiry in media outlets such as the BBC over this. But it's not limited to the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, the Church of Scotland and related bodies also have major problems, largely unknown to the general public at the moment. And you've then got, there are other aspects to this. We keep finding new ones. One is the sex industry, because the sex industry is trafficking girls and boys out of the care homes. And the sex industry is so horrendous in what it does to the people who work in it. There's a constant stream of damaged people coming out of the far end of that industry, and they need a constant throughput of what is often literally called fresh meat going in. And they're not getting this from the adult population, they're getting this from children. And they're getting it primarily from the care homes. So what we're seeing is trafficking from people embedded within the care system into the saunas. And you know, that's the route. So that's one aspect of it. There's another aspect, which is Satanist ritual abuse, which is constantly being decried in the press. And you have QCs and others lining up to say it doesn't exist, but most certainly does, and it does in Scotland. There is one charity in Dundee called Izzy's Promise that deals primarily with the survivors of ritual abuse, and they operate in rings. There is multi-generational familial abuse is part of it, but they operate in networks. And those networks include people in all walks of life.
Now, look, some people will say, including Private Eye, that this satanic ritual abuse doesn't exist. I mean, you said it yourself. People say it doesn't. QCs say it doesn't. Yeah. What evidence have you got that it does?
Well, there is books upon books of evidence have come out of the Izzy's Promise charity. There's PhDs being written on it at the moment. One of the books that was generated by Izzy's Promise was generated by the testimonies of survivors of this type of abuse. Some 18 to 20, as I recall. And an extremely moving book. So what you've got is you've got well-documented evidence from all around the world, Scotland, England, Europe, United States. You're seeing common themes. You're seeing common reports. You're seeing common practices. And you do have a certain amount of it finding its way to the criminal justice system. There's around 10 cases that have been prosecuted successfully in the UK, which have been very clearly Satanist ritual abuse cases, where that aspect of the case has been openly revealed in court. But one of the problems we're seeing is that even where the abuse is successfully prosecuted, the Satanist and ritual aspects of it are not mentioned because the prosecutors believe it is too fantastic to be believed by a jury. So these things are ignored and the concentration is instead placed on the abuse, and the nature and driving force behind it is ignored.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? Nowadays, it seems that judges often advise lawyers not to include very important aspects to cases for that exact reason. And that means, of course, that this aspect of the case doesn't get reported. But anyway, what do you make of the National Inquiry, which is being currently chaired by Alexis Jay? Because it's had a very difficult, troubled start with even Lyle Goddard, who was the third chair, resigning because she wasn't able to choose her own staff. They were being foisted on her by the Home Office, who itself is under investigation for child sexual abuse. I mean, certainly for overseeing a regime of child sexual abuse through state care homes and through the management of the police by the Home Office, etc.
Well, this is one of the problems, and one of the reasons that we exist is that the suggestion that the organisation most singular responsible for covering up abuse, you know, namely the state in all of its branches, be it police, be it judiciary, be it Crown Office in Scotland or Crown Prosecution Service in England, and all of the local authorities who ran the care homes. So this organisation that has been the primary vehicle by which the abuse has been concealed, and it's quite clear that reports were coming out in sufficient quantity with sufficient evidence for action to have been taken many, many years ago, and that action was not taken, and where individual police officers sought to take action, they were being pressured to drop the issue, sometimes not too subtly. So the organisation responsible for the cover-up is now responsible for the investigation, and we're all meant to believe that it will be fine. Now, if you look at the inquiry in England, although they've now got Alexis Jay, who showed considerable courage in her reports before, Rotherham in particular, what happens when someone phones that inquiry? Well, they're actually not speaking to the inquiry, they're speaking to the NSPCC. But the NSPCC are involved in the abuse and the cover-up of abuse like everybody else. So how reliable is that as a method of...
It sounds to me like some sort of outsourcing might be going on. Maybe the government's outsourcing too much here. But I'm not sure. Is Scotland included in this national inquiry? Because if it's not, that would be rather tragic. Northern Ireland, I believe, has been excluded.
Scotland is excluded. Scotland has its own inquiry. And this alone is somewhat problematic because the abuse doesn't respect borders. Some of the most serious abuse we know, I've spoken to people personally who have been trafficked from Scotland to Ireland and to England as children in order to be abused. So how you then draw those boundaries in the investigation, that could be a problem. Now, the Scottish inquiry was very slow in getting started. There was a lot of pressure from within Scotland, a lot of it surrounding the Holly Gregg case, and eventually there was going to be an inquiry. So what happened was, well, for the first year, nothing. And then a board of three people were appointed. Having learned the lessons, you understand, from the situation in England, because by this point, the English inquiry had already gone through two or three heads. So the political spin that was coming was, well, we're not going to rush this decision. So they then appointed three people to head the inquiry, with Susan O'Brien QC being the foremost, and Professor Lamb from, I think, the University of Cambridge was one of the heads of the inquiry. And, excuse me, the long and short of it is all three people resigned. And they resigned citing government interference in the inquiry, in the independent inquiry, as the reason for the resignation. And specifically, they cited interference and pressure from John Swinney, who is the minister responsible in Scotland. And yet Mr. Swinney still has his job. And the inquiry still goes on. Now there's only one person running it, Lady Smith. And the revelations that the government was putting undue pressure on its own independent inquiry, pressures which were financial and legal and personal, because there was personal attacks being made on the chair of the inquiry, quite scurrilous. And and trivial, and yet viewed immediately by the political masters as a sacking offence. It was clear that they were not happy with the way she was running the independent inquiry. And it was also clear that there was nothing that they could criticise her on in the substantive matters of how she was running the inquiry. And it was a whispering campaign that was run instead.
Begin to sound like a whitewash, doesn't it? So what advice would you have for anybody who has, knows people or themselves has been sexually abused as a youngster? Because it doesn't necessarily seem as if the inquiry is the best route. And also, of course, many people are worried about going to the police.
Oh, you've got to be so careful. I mean, this is the huge difficulty. There is no general advice. But what I would say is that people have to be extremely careful. They have to not trust the authorities. They have to weigh up the risks that they're running at every stage. And they have to take responsibility for whatever they do themselves. Let me sort of illustrate this by going back to how one of the charities that we work with who have been dealing with this for years, they started off advising people to go to the police. Now, this is the charity who deals with the ritual abuse victims. And what they were finding is that it was often young women who were trying to escape abusive situations, and they were trying to report the abuse which had happened, and they very often had children. And the first thing that would happen is the authorities would seize their children. And the second thing that would happen is the authorities would give the children to one of the people they had named as an abuser. And this happened over and over and over again. And it got so that the charity no longer advises, and they met lots of good police officers during this point who were trying to do a good job, and then saw these investigations, if they did get started in a positive way, sabotage from on high within the police ranks. Officers would be reassigned and hostile officers would come in their place and this sort of thing. So it got to the situation that the charity now advises the people, if they're being abused, have you got somebody you trust? Have you got somewhere you can run to and you can be safe? And if the answer is yes, the advice is get the kids and go. You don't tell the authorities and you don't tell anyone else. Get the kids and go. So the first thing I would say to any survivor who's trying to decide what to do is you have to make sure that you're safe. And ultimately, your safety and survival comes first. I'm afraid that my conclusion is you cannot trust the authorities. You should not trust the authorities. It's too dangerous. It's too you could be fortunate. You could be very unfortunate. You wouldn't know.
What about small groups, charities like your own? I mean, obviously, not everyone listening to this program will be in Scotland. We're in Bristol. Are there other groups around the country that you could recommend as a possible first point of contact? Not necessarily to pour your heart out to, but at least to try and establish some link to.
I'm less au fait with the groups in England. I know there are. I hear concerns coming from survivor groups in England about some of the other survivor groups. It seems to be, excuse me, there seems to be a considerable degree of conflict and some uncertainty as to which groups can be trusted and which can't. And I can't really speak to the specifics of that, unlike the situation in Scotland, which is smaller and you can actually get to know all the groups. And where you can get a reasonable handle on who you can trust. To give people some advice as to how to approach this, you would want, first of all, to look at the confidentiality policy of any group that you're speaking to, because you want the ability to get confidential advice and confidential discussions so that the individual victim and survivor is in control and can make decisions and it won't be taken out of their hands. So that would be the starting point. Look at how they treat confidentiality. If you find a group that treats confidentiality extremely well, either making it absolute or near absolute, with only very small number of well-defined exceptions, then that would be a starting point where you think, well, this might be a group that I can trust. The next thing is look at the funding. Some groups which receive government funding are okay and resist government pressures. Most don't. So you want to see groups which are not primarily sourced from central funding. Look at the ones which are perhaps rubbing against the authorities and being seen to speak out where some of the things they're saying are not popular, because that gives you an indication that the people involved have the necessary moral courage to stand up to pressure.
Without naming names, can you give us an example of the sorts of people that you've come across, maybe particular cases that have stuck in your mind about? Because, I mean, I think for some people, this is something that they simply do not want to talk about. They don't want to think about it, let alone talk about it. And yet we do have to in order to understand the problem, deal with the problem and sort it out.
Well, the case that got me involved in this to start with is the Holly Gregg case, or rather how a campaigner called Robert Green, who was campaigning on behalf of Holly Gregg, was treated. Because Holly Gregg was a girl from Aberdeen who reported... excuse me, sorry about the cough, who reported that she was abused, including ritual abuse, by two members of the family and 20 other people. And this network, which considered itself or advertised itself to her as a kind of swingers club, this abuse network included people in very high positions. You had school teachers, you had social workers, you had the now deceased head of forensics in Grampian Police, and you had a judge. And all of this was reported to the police. And the response was the forcible sectioning of Holly's mother, who made the report. She was essentially jumped outside of her house, a needle stabbed in her backside, and she woke up in the local mental hospital. When she got out of there, she had herself independently assessed by a psychiatrist and got a completely clean bill of health, and then continued campaigning for justice for her daughter. Robert Green got involved around 2009, from memory, and started the campaign, got a reinvestigation of it, which consisted of Holly being interviewed for 3 hours, and Holly suffers from Down syndrome and has some speech impediments, but her recollection has been extremely accurate, extremely consistent. She named all of the abusers, she described all of the abusers, she described physical aspects of the abusers that she wouldn't know if the abuse hadn't happened. And the result was nothing. There was no further investigation, and none of the people she named was even questioned. No computers were seized, there was nothing. And there continued to be nothing. And then Robert Green, who was campaigning for this, eventually got to a point where he was standing for Parliament and for Aberdeen South, the constituency in which much of the abuse had happened. And when he set foot in Aberdeen, he was immediately arrested on grounds which are now being reassessed by the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission. So I don't want to go into the too much about that, because hopefully that's all going to come back to court. I was involved later in the process when he was arrested for a second time. He was blogging about this, and he was arrested by Police Scotland and Cheshire Police from his home in Cheshire and driven back to Scotland. And he was incarcerated in a jail near where I live, and I started to visit him. And I looked at the case, and I looked at all the documentation surrounding the case, because there's lots of reports and it's all very professionally done. And what that says is the abuse is real. Holly, incidentally, was compensated. She got £13,500 criminal injuries compensation fund money as a victim of abuse. But no one's ever been questioned. This is the concern. Where's the proper investigation?
It's shocking, isn't it, when there's no investigation.
And when you ask the Scottish authorities, you get the same standard set phrase. There's been a full and thorough investigation, and there's insufficient, credible, and admissible evidence in order for the case to proceed. End. And when you say, well, but how can it be a full and thorough investigation when you haven't questioned any of the people who were accused? And the answer is, we've already answered your question, we're not going to correspond with you anymore. So when I start to see this sort of response, as I was starting to ask my own questions, I thought, well, there's something stinks here. This is not right. This is not credible as an open justice system. So I started to, you know, become involved.
Okay, so how many people have you been able to help and how?
Well, we are early days, but we are, as I say at the moment, our group is going around Scotland. We're building, I think, a very good degree of confidence and also discussion, because what we've found is that the people who have been harmed have within themselves the strength, the courage to fight their own case. What they lack is the ability to share the knowledge, because there's all these victims of abuse around the country. And they've all got knowledge of their own case, not only what happened to them, but how the state responded and how the cover-up responded, or how the police acted, or how the local authority acted. And they've got all these little bits of knowledge. What we're looking to do is to join up these pieces of information so that we can give the people who have been harmed a coherent, understandable map of how the system operates and why it fails. And then what we have to do is find a way of giving them a mechanism by which they can get remedy. Now, what we're looking at there is a common law process where people, if the state does not uphold the law, the people uphold the law, right? So we're talking about grand juries and this sort of thing. So that people who have been excluded from justice have some mechanism available to them where they can actually take forward their case, not necessarily within the existing state system, because the existing system is so stacked against them as to be a constant source of frustration and disappointment and anger to these people.
Well, it's almost a kind of compounding the abuse, isn't it? If you're going for some remedy and then you find out that the remedy is a form of abuse too. But anyway, maybe David, you could just tell our listeners how we can follow your work and reach you, I imagine, on the internet.
Yes, I broadcast frequently on the UK column about these matters. You can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is albion_rover. And the Fresh Start Foundation has a website, and that's Fresh Start. Let me make sure I get this right. Yeah, freshstartfoundation.co.uk. And there's emails and links there, and also links to our video output. So all of our events, which will eventually number 36, are all videoed, and the videos have been placed on the website and on YouTube, which is also accessible via the website. So you can follow all the speeches, all the talks, all the discussion. And it's a discussion that's really been the most interesting thing, that our understanding of how we go about solving this problem, of how we go about achieving a win, not simply discussing how bad it all is, but making change happen, compelling change to happen.
I mean, and one of the most important things you're doing is, of course, creating this kind of intelligence map of where the abuse is taking place and the networks that are doing the abuse. So I wonder, is there anywhere in the criminal justice system that you think really change needs to happen before there'll be any progress?
The key point, and there's two aspects to that. The key point in the criminal justice system, certainly in Scotland, is the Crown Office, which is the Crown Prosecution Service equivalent. They have decision over essentially everything. They control the criminal justice system in Scotland to a much greater extent than the CPS does in England, because there is no private prosecution in Scotland, for all practical purposes. It doesn't exist. Even TV licensing and things like this, they don't have any prosecutorial role. The taxman doesn't have a prosecutorial role in Scotland. It's all through the Crown Office. So the fact that there's no options there, and 40% of the cases that go into the Crown Office and there's enough evidence never proceed. So there's a big rejection pile and a huge amount of ability for them to say, well, this isn't in the public interest, without ever really having oversight as to what that means. So essentially, the biggest thing that would change the case here is if the victims had a choice between more than one prosecutor. That would change things. Now, the other thing you mentioned there is gathering information. Yes, we are in the process of creating a database of all of the recorded abuse within Scotland. It's based on the Wikipedia underpinnings, and we call it Wikipedo. And this, once it goes live to the public, will allow people to search on any institution, on any town, on any region in Scotland, and see exactly what has been recorded in the past. So all these press reports, which appall people for 2 days and then are forgotten, it's bringing all of these together, and it's revealing the patterns of abuse and the scale of abuse, and it's really really quite stunning. And okay. We hope to have that launched to the public in a few months.
Okay. If anyone is, you know, wondering, should I do something about abuse that I've got or friends of mine have got, is there any way to know when the time is right to say something and to actually maybe to start your road to try and get justice?
It's very much for the individual to chart their own path, and it's not for us to tell people what to do with their life story. What I would say is what we are looking to provide for people is the ability to have to regain their self-respect by having the power to compel change, having the power to seek justice actively and personally and effectively. So that's our role. We're looking to create a process where that can happen. And it's the difference between people thinking, I've been abused for all these years, I've had the abuse, and then I've had the memory of the abuse, and there's no justice, and there's nothing I can do. And that takes people to a very dark place, and a place perhaps without much hope. And instead of that, we're seeing people who are standing up, they're telling their story, and that's not for everyone because it's difficult, but certainly some people feel called to do that. And they're tackling the authorities, and by drawing together with other people who have been through the same sort of trouble, and with people who want to help and want to support them, they're making a difference to their own lives. And I think that's one of the most important things, is to see people who have been so badly abused regain their own self-respect. Is maybe not quite the right phrase, but there's a chap called Jordan Peterson who's quite well known on the internet, and he's talking about free speech and many things. And he was talking about the biblical phrase, the meek shall inherit the earth. He said, I never understood this. I thought meek was quite a poor thing to be. Why would you want to be meek? And he said, I realized after a while, I found out the original meaning. And it wasn't what we now understand meek to be. What it meant was having a sword and knowing how to use it, but having the discipline and forbearance to keep it sheathed. That's what that means. That's what we are looking to give people.
I mean, there was also the case, wasn't there, with Princess Diana, who actually went to Camilla's sister Annabelle's party one evening with Prince Charles, in the knowledge that Charles was having an affair with Camilla, and confronted her in front of the guests. From that point on, it's rather a brave thing to do. From that point on, the bulimia ceased, and she started to get her courage back. So actually, by having this stuff out in public, sometimes can make a massive difference to people's self-esteem, to their confidence.
Well, this is it. Yes. one of the people who's going to be talking soon at our event had the courage to speak about what happened. And in this case, it was the Roman Catholic Church, Roman Catholic clergy, who had been abusing him horrendously and repeatedly. He spoke out and was castigated in the press, called a drunk and called a liar and called a fantasist by a cardinal in the church, a respected man of the church. Now, that was years ago. And in the environment that we had then, a lot of people in his community would have believed the respected man of the church and not him. And he had a very long and hard path, but he's still there and he's still speaking the truth. I think we're in a position now where these sort of early people who showed the courage to speak out have opened the door to so many other people who can now be believed in a way they wouldn't be have been believed before. The person who called this man a drunk is now himself a sad, drunken former cardinal. And the credibility of the organization he represents is no longer there on these matters. And the simple, truthful statement that the person who had been abused was making is now being believed. So that was a long process, but that was a long process because he started when no one was talking about these things. We've now reached a point where the public are much more willing to hear and are much more willing to believe the abuse survivors.
But it seems perhaps the police still aren't.
The police are in places. The police are not in other places. The problem with the police is there's more than one police force. There's a force within a force. There are places in Scotland where you will not see justice if you cross the wrong people because the police will make sure you don't. And there are places where the police will be excellent. So the police, if you're going to the police, you have to try and decide who the people are you're dealing with. One of the things to watch for is interviews with a chap called John Wedger. He's a police officer from England and he spoke at one of our events. Now he was put under tremendous pressure. He's a police whistleblower and he was put under enormous personal pressure. I mean, we're talking all income cut off, so he couldn't pay the mortgage, he couldn't feed his kids, threats of being imprisoned, which for a police officer's almost a death sentence. He was put under unbelievable pressure to keep his mouth shut. The pressure started to ease when he spoke out anyway, and he's now campaigning very vigorously for truth and justice. And the area where he was whistleblowing was in the area of child sexual abuse. And the nature of the pressure that he was that he was subjected to is something that everyone should understand. So look out for videos with John Wedger because it illustrates what the police force is like. You have excellent men and women and you have people who are going to cover up the most horrendous abuse in order to further their own careers. And that's the nature of the body. You have to understand if you're going to interact with them the dangers that you're running, and the fact that there can be excellent people in those uniforms.
David Scott, can you just remind us how we can get hold of you or email you if necessary or find you online?
Email northern_exposure@hushmail.com. We have Twitter is albion_rover. The website for the Fresh Start Foundation is freshstartfoundation.co.uk, and you'll see me most Fridays on the UK column reporting with their daily news show.
David Scott, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sean Williams and Phoebe Holmes from Friends of the Earth, and also to David Scott from the Fresh Start Foundation. Also to studio engineers David Bazenko and Balti Campos. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till the same time next week here on Dialect, goodbye for now.
Suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
You are listening to a test transmission for a new form of information transfer. Not only are you receiving audio, but you are also receiving image and text data. Test transmission begin. For further information on any aspects of this broadcast, contact P.O. Box 1871, London W10 5ZL. Copyright has been retained in the Sound and Vision.
Together on this, okay? Now, I want the names of all the places you lived, all the schools you went to, friends, enemies, acquaintances, good memories and bad. I used to imagine what it might be like. What might be like?
Target appears to be activated. Repeat, repeat. Target appears to be activated.